They rested through the middle of each day, lying in the meagre strip of shade cast by the animals. The camels were couched in direct sunlight, which would have brought the blood of any other man or beast to the boil, but they showed no discomfort. As soon as the tyranny of the sun abated, they rode on through the evening and the night. In the dawn of the third day, while the eternal lamp of the morning star still burned above the horizon, Penrod left Jacob with the camels and climbed to the top of a conical hill, the only feature in this burnt-out, desolate world. By the time he reached the summit, day had broken, and an extraordinary sight awaited him. 2 miles ahead, something white as salt and graceful as the wing of a gull glided across this ocean of sterile sand and rock. He knew what it was before he lifted the field glasses to his eyes. He stared at the single, bulging lateen sail which seemed so out of place in such a setting. He wasted a little more time revelling in the sense of relief and accomplishment that settled over him. The white wing of the dhow sailed upon the waters of the Nile. They approached the river with the utmost caution. While the terrors of the Mother of Stones were behind them, a new menace lay ahead. Men. The dhow had passed out of sight downstream. When they reached the river bank, it was deserted, revealing no sign of human habitation. Only a flock of white egrets flew eastwards in an arrowhead formation, low across the steely waters. There was a narrow fringe of vegetation along each bank, a few clumps of reed, scraggy palms, and a single magnificent sycamore tree with its roots almost planted in the mud at the edge. An ancient mud-brick tomb had been built in its shade. The plaster was cracked, and lumps had fallen out of the walls. Faded coloured ribbons fluttered from the spreading branches above it.
"That is the tree of St. Al-Maula, a holy hermit who lived at this place 100 years ago," said Jacob. "Pilgrims have placed those ribbons in his honour, so that the saint might remember them and grant any boon they seek. We are 2 leagues west of the ford, and the village of Corti lies about the same distance to the east."
They turned away from the river bank so that they would not be seen by the crews of any passing dhows, and made their way westward through wadis and tumbled hillocks until they reached a tall stone bluff that overlooked a long stretch of the Nile. For the rest of that day they kept their vigil from the summit of the cliff. Although the Nile was the main artery of trade and travel for an area larger than the whole of Western Europe, not another vessel passed, and there was no sign of any human presence along this section of the banks. This alone made Penrod uneasy. Something must have disrupted all commerce along the river. He was almost certain that this was what Bakita had warned him of, and that somewhere close by a massive movement of the Dervish armies was underway. He wanted to get across into the wastes of the Monacer Desert as soon as possible, and to keep well away from the banks until he was opposite the city of Khartoum and could make a final dash into Gordon's beleaguered stronghold. When the angle of the sun altered, it penetrated the water, and the darker outline of the shallows was just visible. A submerged spur of rock pushed halfway across the stream, and from the opposite side an extensive mud bank spread out to meet it. The channel between the two shallows was deep green, but narrow, less than 150 paces across. Penrod memorized its position carefully. If they used the empty water skins as lifebuoys, they could swim the camels across the deeper section. Of course, they must cross in darkness. They would be terribly vulnerable if they were caught in midstream in broad daylight, should a dervish dhow appear unexpectedly. Once they had reached the far bank, they could refill the skins and press on into the monastery. In the last hour of daylight, Penrod left Jacob with the animals on the heights of the bluff and went down alone to examine the bank for tracks. After casting well up and downstream, he was satisfied that no large contingents of enemy troops had passed recently. As darkness fell, Jacob brought down the string of camels. He had emptied the last of the water from the skins, blown them up and stoppered them again. Each camel had a pair of these huge black balloons strapped to its flanks. They were roped together in 2 strings so that they would not become separated in the water. The camels jibbed at entering the water, but Penrod and Jacob goaded them down the bank and out onto the spur. As they headed into the middle of the Nile, the water rose until it reached the men's chins, and they had to cling to the camel harness. The long legs and necks of the beasts allowed them to cross almost to the far side before they lost their footing and were forced to swim awkwardly. But the water skins buoyed them up, and Penrod and Jacob swam beside them, urging them on and pointing their heads in the right direction, taking care to keep clear of their driving front legs below the surface. They swam them to the mud bank on the far side, and when they had regained their footing, led them out onto dry ground. Quickly they refilled the water skins and gave the camels their last drink for many days. The crossing had taken longer than Penrod had bargained on, and the eastern sky was already paling before they were ready to leave the Nile, the skins filled tight and the camels' bellies swollen with water. Before they set out, they tried to obliterate their tracks from the riverbank, but with that number of heavily laden animals and working in darkness, it was impossible. They had to take a chance that the wind and the river waters would wipe away their tracks before they were discovered by Dervish scouts. However, a dark premonition of evil rode on Penrod's shoulders as they headed out into the Monacea Desert. After a few hours' travel, the feeling grew so pervasive that he knew he must sweep the back trail to reassure himself that their crossing had not been discovered. He picked out the fleetest, most willing animal from their string. By now they knew each beast well by temperament and capability. He sent Jacob ahead with the others while he returned along their back trail. When he was still some miles from the river, he left the trail and headed for a line of low hills he had noticed earlier that overlooked the river. He couched and tethered his mount below the skyline, then crept forward. As he neared the crest of the hill, he dropped to his belly, slithered up behind an outcrop of rocks, and peered down into the valley of the Nile. His heart jumped against his ribs, and his nerves whipped tight at what he saw below him. A small party of Dervish scouts was dismounted on the near bank of the Nile, and it was obvious that they had discovered the spoor as it emerged from the water. Through the field glasses he studied the enemy intently. There were six of them. He thought that one might be the man he had chased from Mabad Tega, but he could not be certain. They were all lean, hard desert Arabs, probably of the Bajar tribe. They wore the gaily patched jibbas of the Mahdists and carried the distinctive round targes and long-sheathed swords. They were leaning on the shafts of their spears and animatedly discussing the tracks on the bank. One turned and pointed south along the run of the spoor, and they all looked in the direction he had indicated. They seemed to be gazing directly towards the spot where Penrod lay. He ducked behind the rocks while he assessed the situation. It seemed obvious that the man he had chased from Mabad Tega, even if that was not him down there, had reached the river ahead of them. He must have spread the warning to the forward elements of the main Dervish army coming down from the north. Perhaps one of the commanding emirs had sent this scouting party ahead to reconnoitre the river crossings and intercept them. Penrod could tell at a glance that these were Agajies, the finest Dervish warriors. He and Jacob were outnumbered by 3-1. And the Dervish were on the alert. He put out of his mind any notion of a fight. Their only salvation lay in flight. Now he switched his attention from the men to their mounts. Each rode a handsome horse. They had only one pack camel to carry the leather bags of small gear, food and ammunition, but there were no water skins. Obviously they were a swift scouting party, but because they carried no water, they were confined to the narrow strip of ground a few miles each side of the river. They were not equipped for a deep foray into the Monacea. To intercept Penrod's caravan, they would have to ride hard around the great loop of the river and try to get ahead of them on the riverbank opposite Khartoum. That journey was almost 200 miles longer than the one that faced him and Jacob. He felt a great wave of relief as he realized that even the swiftest horses would not be able to cut them off before they reached their goal. "I leave you to the mercy of Allah," he murmured in sardonic blessing, then wriggled back from the skyline to return to his mount and catch up with Jacob. Then an unexpected stir among the men below made him pause. Quickly he refocused the field glasses. Two of the Agajies had run back to the single-pack camel and forced it to kneel. They unstrapped some equipment from the animal's back. One of the Arabs squatted cross-legged with what appeared to be a writing tablet on his lap. He wrote with great concentration and care. The other man took down a small crate from the camel's load and removed the cotton cover that protected it. He opened a trap door in the lid and reached inside with both hands. Penrod quailed as he saw a small bird-like head bobbing and weaving between the man's fingers. The writer laid aside his pen, carefully folded his message, and stood up. The other man proffered the creature he held, and they were busy for a moment longer. Then the scribe stood back and nodded. With both hands, the other tossed the sleek grey pigeon high into the air. The bird exploded into flight. Its wings clattered softly as it rose higher and higher above the river. All the Arabs watched it, heads thrown back. Their faint cries of encouragement reached Penrod even at that distance. "Fly, little one, on the wings of God's angels, swiftly to the bosom of the Holy Mahdi." Up and up the pigeon climbed, and then it described a series of wide circles in the sky, a speck against the blue, until at last it found its bearings and shot away in a straight, swift line, headed into the south across the loop towards the dervish city of Omdurman. Penrod watched it out of sight, longing to see the knife-winged silhouette of one of the desert Saker falcons towering above it, then beginning the deadly stoop. But no predator appeared, and the pigeon vanished. Penrod ran down the back slope of the hill and sprang into his camel saddle. He turned its head in the same southerly direction as the pigeon had taken and urged it into the pacing gait that it could maintain for 50 miles without rest. But the pigeon would reach Omdurman before nightfall, while he and Jacob still had at least 250 miles to ride. He knew now what a terrible gauntlet they had yet to run before he could reach Khartoum and deliver his dispatch to Chinese Gordon.